Welcome to the 8th episode of Identity International's webinar series, Kashmir Beyond Conflict. This series will be running throughout the month of October every Thursday and Saturday at 5 p.m. British Summer Time, where we will delve into the complexities of Kashmiri identity with our esteemed guests. To receive notifications and updates regarding the series, please follow our social media platforms. And if you have missed any of our interviews so far, please check them out on our YouTube channel. Today, we'll be in conversation with Muzammil Eyyub Thakur. Muzammil is an activist, financial consultant, philanthropist, and son of late exiled Kashmiri activist and nuclear physicist Dr. Eyyub Thakur. He has carried on his father's legacy through his own advocacy and as director of the Justice Foundation, Kashmir Institute of International Affairs, and the president of the World Kashmir Freedom Movement. Muzammil is a prominent Kashmiri analyst and therefore has appeared on multiple news outlets such as Indus News, TRT, and BBC. Muzammil, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
The first question that I would like to pose to you, and you must have quite a unique perspective on this considering you've lived in exile for most of your life. And it's, what does it mean to you personally to be Kashmiri?
Let me flip the question towards you for a moment. And in the near month-long interviews that you've done, what have you surmised about the Kashmiri identity from different people that you've spoken to?
Well, it's varied from people sort of drawing upon their ethnic identity to their, you know, more national identity to them more sort of, I mean, it's varied. I think from, you know, different people from different sides of the borders as well, you know, but what I've noticed as a commonality is the fact that the conflict and sort of how Pakistan and India have treated Kashmiris have really had an impact on how people have perceived themselves to be as Kashmiris. Usually it's a result of that, and they formed it in a form of as an other to whatever Pakistan and India has portrayed the conflict as. You know, I mean, that's what I've basically noticed throughout the interviews that we've done so far, which has been very, very interesting to note.
It's pretty accurate. Everybody's perceptions and understandings is different based on the experiences that they have. Mine is slightly more complex. You mentioned that I was born in exile, and that kind of framed a lot of my understanding of Kashmir. So growing up, it was just me, my mom, my dad, and eventually my sisters, my two younger sisters. But in the beginning, it was just us. So for me, Kashmir or being a Kashmiri meant whatever, you know, was happening at home. So the language, the culture, the ideas and the way to speak. It was very limiting in that sense of what is a Kashmiri, because I was kind of being raised in the UK. And I was sitting with Indians who didn't accept me. I was sitting with Pakistanis who were extremely friendly with me, but I had nothing in common with them. And of course, the British just ostracized us. I mean, we're talking about the mid-80s, late 80s, so it was a very different time to what it is now. So I didn't quite fit in anywhere. And I didn't entirely know who I was. So when we talk about identity, normally you have an immediate identity. Yes, I knew I was male. Yes, I knew that I was a Muslim. Yes, I knew I was a Kashmiri, but it didn't really factor in. When you say that you're British, you know you're British because you eat fish and chips, or you go to the local doner kebab place, or you watch football, or you watch cricket. I mean, these things are enforced. But when you're living away from home and you've never experienced what other people have experienced, for example, in Urdu, you would say cha-cha, cha-ji. In ours, we would say pitar, pechin, mamu, mami, nani, dada. I mean, I knew what they meant. I just didn't know how that felt. We have a concept called matamal, which means your mother's side of the family. I knew what that meant. I'd never seen it. And you have, you know, people were talking about vazwan, which is our traditional dishes of food. And I understood what it was. I'd never tasted it. People talked about the waterfall in Kashmir called Aharbal, and how when the water would fall into the river and the splashes would touch the sky. I'd heard about it, never seen it. So for me, that identity, I wasn't able to relate to it for a long time. I mean, being young, you don't quite grasp all of these things. And then as I grew up, getting older and older, and I started to see what my father was doing and not quite understanding. You see, a lot of the times when you grow up, the first people that you take inspiration from or you take wisdom from are your parents. And of course, I more often than not, I'd see my father out of the house, leaving early, coming late, going abroad, having stress, always watching the news, talking to people on the phone. And I didn't quite understand. I thought this was normal. I mean, as a child, you don't go into other people's homes and see that, you know, how their families function. So I knew how my family functioned. And I thought it was normal. But then as you grow older and you see things and you understand things, and you start hearing things and it starts to absorb inside of you that there's a war, there's a conflict, there is occupation, there's death, destruction, rapes, half-widows, murders, enforced disappearances, mass graves, then you start to realize that these are words that aren't in my everyday vocabulary. So I had to understand what it was. I started to spend more time with my father, go to his events, listen to what he was saying. And that's when it started to dawn on me, you know, so what is actually being a Kashmiri? It's all of this stuff. It isn't just an identity. It's the sanctity of that identity, something that people take for granted, especially those that live in lands where there is no conflict. So identity for me was remembrance of the atrocities of what's happening in Kashmir. Identity to me meant resistance in the face of occupation, resistance in the face of subjugation, resistance in the face of oppression. And then that identity started to develop over time, reading. Now, there's this term that people use called Wikipedia scholars, and I probably was one of them. You know, you can read as much as you want, but until you actually experience that for yourself, you don't quite grasp or appreciate the situation and circumstances. So once I was able to travel to Kashmir, that's when it actually hit me what my identity actually is. It is beyond culture. It is the culture of resistance. It is beyond identity. It is the identity that we resist with and what for. It is beyond language. It is linguistic resistance. And for me, ultimately, boiling it all down, what being a Kashmiri means to me is resistance. Resistance against the Indian occupation. Resistance against the annihilation of our people. Resistance against our ethnic cleansing, our genocide, the war crimes that are happening inside Kashmir. Current demographic change, the settler colonial project that is in full swing. That is essentially how I came to the realization of my identity is, and I'm sure that many different people will have many different versions, and this is the blunt version that I'm trying to give, and I'm sure that it is probably the common denominator between all Kashmiris, that although different people will have different perspectives and understandings, but the root and the commonality between us all is probably going to boil down to this: resistance in the face of occupation, and trying to preserve your own identity, trying to preserve your history, which is in our case is also being cleansed. In a nutshell, that's what it is. That is as blunt and as concise as I can keep it. I mean, I can tell you about growing up and experiencing different cultures and identities and not seeing other Kashmiris and not understanding why I can't travel and why I can't go to Kashmir. But ultimately, once all of that was understood over many, many years, and then living in Kashmir for a while, then seeing different people's experiences, and then experiencing it myself, and then realizing with stories of what it meant to be in exile and how my own birth was a political resistance. I mean, my father was exiled, and then, you know, I wasn't even permitted to be born in Kashmir, to the extent that my father has passed away and we weren't even able to bury him in Kashmir. So everything about us is political, but it is political resistance against what India is doing to us and against us, in a nutshell.
Do you feel, you know, living in the UK and observing these things from a distance, has that impacted your visual, like, you know, your perception of Kashmir in comparison to Kashmiris that are actually living there?
Well, you see, that's a good question. I was debating this with myself as well. And while I was away from Kashmir, I would probably agree that, you know, you can read books and you can read news articles and you can watch the news and you can hear stories, when you do research, there's primary research and secondary research and such. So in that sense, I was in like kind of the bottom bracket that, you know, because I couldn't go. But then once I was able to go, and then once I started living there for several years, and then witnessing firsthand what is happening, listening, directly from victims experiencing certain things that, you know, maybe I can't share online and to the public. But that's when it started changing, that it became less academic and more real. Because when you see, or when you have to bury your friends and family, and not because of natural causes, there is more emphasis and more realization of what the situation is, what the circumstances is. And the people inside Kashmir, obviously, I can understand that being in the diaspora, many people will consider that those living in the diaspora are living luxurious lives and they don't know what it's like to be in Kashmir all this time. That's absolutely true. That is absolutely true. It is only the people on the ground that truly know what happens inside Kashmir. They've experienced it from their birth to the day that they die. And people, I mean, it's not normal to be born in occupation and only know occupation. It's not normal. So there is a lack of sometimes clarity and understanding between diaspora and those living on the ground. But it is necessary for people like myself and others that live in the diaspora to regularly go to Kashmir and not just limit our information to news articles and so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that. It is about getting that experience. And I'm not saying that everybody should start stone pelting or go be arrested or be pellet ridden, but meet the victims. And it's not just about empathy and sympathy. It is literally about living in their shoes, just even for a few moments, and understanding what kind of pain they actually have and listening to their stories and understanding what their desires are. Sometimes we impose our own because of our own experiences and our own the environment that we've been brought up in and things that we've studied and living in the West and technology and development, and we think that we know better. But that's not the reality. The reality is you have to somehow marry those ideals with the ideals of what is happening on the ground in the valley. And you have to be able to muster some kind of common minimum agenda. I mean, if I can coin that term, a common minimum goal to make them understand what the realities of the outside world is, but also that we understand what the realities on the ground is, because sitting here, we can never truly understand what people are going through on a day-to-day basis.
Do you think that's one of the biggest issues in sort of resolving the conflict as well, with the external sort of, you know, external like groups or people that are trying to impact the conflict from the outside? Because there's a disconnect between the people that are living under the occupation and the regimes that are trying to take over, and then the other people that are trying to help from, with, you know, from the outside. Is there a huge disconnect between the two?
No, I don't think so. I think on some level there might be, but not on the fundamental basis of azadi or the sanctity of freedom. I think if there is resistance from any side, from any direction, it is always India. You have to remember when the international community talk about Kashmir, India says that this is a bilateral issue between India and Pakistan. When Pakistan say, fine, let's get onto the negotiating table, India says that this is an internal matter. And when the Kashmiris say, fine, don't talk to Pakistan, talk to us, India says there is no issue. So we have to see the root of the problem. The root of the problem is never going to be those advocates and those people that are trying to lobby the cause of Kashmir. Everybody does it from the goodness of their heart. There is no vendetta or vindictiveness. There may be a lack of understanding, there may be a lack of clarity, but there is a fundamental understanding between all Kashmiris that India is the occupier, India is the oppressor, we must end this occupation, we must end the human rights violations, we must end the siege, the crimes that are being committed inside Kashmir. Everybody understands this. It's always India that tries to fudge the issue, that tries to dilute the issue, that tries to prop up fake politicians and representatives, that tries to take the issue of Kashmir to the United Nations and then kind of prepare a smear campaign against Pakistan, because they know. Let me give you a simple example. India is considered, I mean, this is public knowledge, so I'm not demonizing India. It is what it is. India is considered to be, as particularly Delhi, is considered to be the rape capital of the world. There is no intervention. There is no criminalizing of India. At the most, you hear maybe Donald Trump a day or 2 days ago saying that India is a dirty country. That is as bad as it gets. And then 24 hours later, he talks about how they need to have closer ties. That is the relationship that India has with the rest of the world. In Pakistan, I mean, if, excuse my language, but if somebody in Pakistan burps slightly loudly, suddenly there's accusations of chemical warfare. I mean, this is the policy of India. So there is no true, there is no argument that I could accept that there is a disconnect from between the ground and the diaspora, and that is why that we are being able to push this case forward. It is India that consistently and continuously and quite regularly. I mean, there is a pattern here that they prop up different people to propagate their own agenda. The best example is, the most immediate example is the PDP alliance that they had, Mehbooba Mufti, installed her as the chief minister of Kashmir, and then jailed her. This is the same woman that went to bed with the BJP and then suddenly was jailed and locked up. So India have their mechanisms. They sponsor different people to go to different locations and dilute the cause of Kashmir, to equate Azad Kashmir with Indian occupied Kashmir, equate Pakistan with India, because India knows what the narrative in the rest of the world is, what is more palatable, what is more acceptable. So the root cause is always going to be India. And of course, I mean, we regularly blame the international community, and we say the United Nations doesn't do anything. But, you know, although I accept that argument, but the problem is, when has the United Nations actually done anything without, you know, political pressure from nations that have veto power, be it the United States, China, whatever it is? I mean, we saw South Sudan and North Sudan and how that was resolved. We saw East Timor, how that was resolved. Rwanda, that issue was resolved. But, you know, there are pressures and political pressures that are in place to do that. And it's always India that is always committing those roadblocks and those hurdles to maintain their occupation of Kashmir. Not only maintain it, but to enforce it, to make it worse. And to the extent that nobody really cares. You get a few shouts here and there for a couple of months, and then suddenly the international community dies down in their noise.
That is, I mean, it's interesting because I guess it's the economic and the political powers and the sort of allies and treaties and contracts that you have between countries and such, and that affects people on the ground to such an extent that, and people don't realize, I guess, this more underlying influence that it has on places like Kashmir. I guess, more towards on a personal level, as you know, more towards just what we're trying to unpick over here at the moment, is when you came across people from either side of the border, right? Some from Pakistan side or India side. Do you think that there have been differences that have evolved over time whilst the conflict has been taking place?
Yes and no. You see, I'm very blessed. I'm not sure, I can't say this with statistics and facts, but I'm probably one of the very rare people that have been able to travel to both India and Pakistan, that have been able to travel to Indian occupied Kashmir and Azad Kashmir. And I've seen the situation and circumstances in Azad Kashmir. Some people that claim POK, that term, it does a disservice to the people of Indian occupied Kashmir. You cannot possibly equate the two. It's just not possible. I've seen it. You can't, I don't want to use foul language, but you cannot, again, I can't think of another term, but you can't tell somebody like me what is happening in Azad Kashmir because I've been there. You don't see the human rights violations. You don't see the occupation. You don't see every 100 yards a military personnel. You don't see civil liberties being curtailed the way that it's happening in Indian-occupied Kashmir. It is a completely different setup there. But there are different people that have different perspectives. There are different people that have different ideologies and philosophies. And that's fine. We shouldn't denounce each other. Somebody may be, pro-independence. Somebody might be pro-Pakistan. Somebody might even be pro-India. But you can't denounce them. The problem is that they have been there. They are the sum of their experiences. Their circumstances are such that is what they believe. You must understand where that stems from, and then intellectually argue that point. And then, unfortunately, we have differences amongst ourselves in the diaspora. But ultimately, it comes back to the same thing, that the primary role, the primary issue, is the Indian occupation of Kashmir. Once that is resolved, then we can talk about a plebiscite. We can talk about what the United Nations have mentioned in their Security Council resolutions. We've seen the reports. I think, 2 years ago, the United Nations Human Rights Commission's report on Kashmir, 3/4 of that report was documenting the extent of the human rights violations that are happening inside Indian-occupied Kashmir, and 1/4 of it was dedicated to Azad Kashmir. And if you read that report, most of the issues that are happening in Azad Kashmir, by political standards, if we try to create an understanding of that terminology, they are mostly administrative problems. most of them are administrative problems. I mean, look, we hear about in the United Kingdom or anywhere in the world, you hear about oppression against minorities or, you know, the police brutality and that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that you can't call that an occupation. There are, granted, there are massive problems in Azad Kashmir. Most of them I probably wouldn't be able to understand, nor would I be able to convey. But from what I have seen and the way that people speak about Azad Kashmir, it is a disservice to the movement of freedom.
Because of the discrepancies between the two, I guess, major discrepancies between the two. And you see that, I mean, I think I've noticed that as well, talking to people from either side, there is, people, from what I've noticed, at least, or the Kashmiris that I've come across, from Azad Kashmir that have been living in the UK, they seem to, you know, not know as much about the conflict or not aware as much of the conflict as people from the, you know, Indian, you know, side of Kashmir or the valley, and the way that it's sort of evolved into their identity and their occupations to the point as well, you know, it defines a lot of what they've become. Obviously this affects a lot of your advocacy and your activism and how you've, evolved into your career and as such. Would you like to comment on that a bit more about how?
I live, breathe and eat and dream Kashmir. It's a problem. It really is. To the extent that, you know, when I watch a movie, there are dialogues in there that resonate with me because I relate it to Kashmir. I see maybe a clip and I understand how that reflects on Kashmir. I read a book and the texts I try to apply on Kashmir. For people that come from an occupied territory, it is not just in their DNA, it is in everything, in their soul, in every fiber of their being, that everything reminds them of their home, everything reminds them of the occupation, everything reminds them of the will to resist. And our existence or our resistance is existence. And that said, the way that we operate or the way different people have their ideologies and philosophies and the way that they're brought up, it matters. So when you, I'm trying to make it, let's talk about the Palestinians, for example. Mm-hmm. Very rarely, personally, I haven't seen it. I'm sure that others have, but I have not seen a single Palestinian that is not political, that doesn't know about their homeland. If you ask any Kashmiri that, you know, leaves Kashmir to study, to work or anything, it is still in their DNA. They try to maintain that identity, that culture, that language, and any opportunity that they get, they will try and contribute towards Kashmir, be it charitable, be it political, be it diplomatic, in whatever shape or form, because we've seen the conflict. We've experienced that conflict, some more than others, most more than others. And that defines us. And because of that definition of children of conflict, and then seeing how the rest of the world operates, and this isn't the 80s and 90s anymore, where the internet is rare or non-existent. Now everybody inside Kashmir knows what happens outside of the world, and they aspire for better. They realize that this is not normal. And that if other conflicts can be resolved, then why not ours? And people like those in the diaspora also realize that, you know, we have slightly better now connectivity to the ground, and we don't get information a month or 2 months late. We get immediate information more often than not when the internet is working. And with that comes a responsibility to convey that information, to lobby, to protest, to do something to alleviate the suffering inside Kashmir, because alleviating that suffering inside Kashmir alleviates the burden on our souls, on our conscience, that at least we are contributing in some way, whatever little way that it is. And that is how we live on a daily basis. I can't represent the entire Kashmiri diaspora. I can at least talk about some of us that we work with, most of the people that I know, that this is how it is on a daily basis for all of us.
Has it affected the way that you maneuver through British society?
Has it affected?
Just on the way that you maneuver throughout British society, like while you're in England?
Yes, personally, yes. When I started to get more involved in the Kashmir cause, and it kind of, I was absorbed into it. And so I used to be involved in different projects and different proposals and different organizations, be they, you know, non-governmental or not or whatnot. And then I started to, my own desires of freedom used to creep into the agendas and ideologies. And there's a phrase, again, I don't, it is a very bad example, but basically I used to be a broken record. So anything that anybody was speaking about, some way, in any shape or form, I would try and link it back to Kashmir just to make sure that they understood that Kashmir is also a cause. If we're talking about enforced disappearances in Africa, Kashmir also has that. If we talk about rape victims in I don't know, the Balkans, when the issue in the Balkans happened, or the Baltic states, sorry, I say that Kashmir is also there as well. When we talk about the right to self-determination for the people of Sudan or East Timor, I say Kashmir is there as well. When we talk about ethnic cleansing or settler colonial projects in Palestine, I say Kashmir as well. So yeah, the way that I maneuver in society, fortunately, unfortunately, for me, it's always with the mindset that can this be a contribution towards Kashmir in any shape or form? Is it possible? To the extent that my social life is in disarray, because I, like I said, I'm a broken record. For me, everything is about Kashmir. If you ask my family, they're probably sick and tired of me only talking about Kashmir and relating everything to Kashmir. But the problem is that when you grow up in a certain environment, you know, first the concept of exile, I mean, it's not a term that children should know about, or genocide or ethnic, I mean, these are terms that are not normal to not even exist, but even to then learn as a child. And then when that's your upbringing and that's all you know, conflict is all you know, then it becomes a responsibility, especially when you realize the privilege that you have, the luxury that you have of living in the West and not being able to contribute. That is a sin.
What does the future look like to you for Kashmir? I'm not asking for like a more, you know, of course, a utopian idealistic kind of perception, but realistically speaking, knowing the factors, especially considering what's happening in similar, conflicts that you could draw parallels upon, like Palestine, and the way that's going so far, what do you see as Kashmir's future at the moment?
The destination is important. The destination is obviously the right to self-determination, to allow the people to decide their own fate. How realistic that is in the short term, medium, long term, I don't know. We can only attempt, we can try, we can hope. Although the destination is important, it is the path that you choose that is also important. The way that you conduct yourself, the way that you represent, the way that you lobby, the way that you convey the cause of Kashmir to the wider world. So to answer your question, it isn't about just the aspiration of freedom. It is about the methodology toward it and understanding the wider ramifications, geostrategic, political. You now have China involved. You have the CPEC issue. You have India, Pakistan, Russia on some level, America, the UK, Europe. You have the issue of Brexit, how that negotiation is happening with India. There are so many different things that are happening at the same time. And, if the issue of, East Timor can be resolved and Sudan and all these other conflicts that have had some kind of resolution, then there is no reason why Kashmir cannot be resolved according to the wishes of the people of Kashmir. But the way that I see, what do I see for Kashmir? Obviously, I see the aspiration for freedom. I see a free Kashmir without the occupation, people living their lives the way they want to, education, health, wealth, having the same rights that everybody else in the world has, but with freedom, without subjugation, without occupation, without oppression, equality. But to get to that point is the important task. A lot of the times we fight over the end solution of Kashmir, what it should look like. And because of that discrepancy between people's ideologies, we start parting ways. We take different paths. We shun one another because of that ideology without realizing that you are falling into the trap of the oppressor, of the occupier, because they wish to sow seeds of discord amongst us. So That is why I believe it is the path that you take that is important. It is the journey that is as important as the destination.
What does that look like? The methodology, the journey, the path to get to this point, in your opinion, at least. It's a difficult thing to come to a consensus on.
It really is. It really is. Because there's also the something that we need to understand. There is a generational change as well. Those people that started the movement, or launched the movement, be it in the 30s, be it in the 40s, be it in the 80s and 90s, or now. I mean, generations have changed, continents have drifted, new nations have been formed. So therefore, strategies must also be, strategies must also evolve. And for that, it requires different people in the diaspora and on the ground to come to a consensus of what the future will look like. I mean, this isn't one Muzammil Thakur that is going to be able to give a roadmap, because my ideology or my strategy is going to be based on certain experiences. And no matter how open-minded I think that I am, but there will always be roadblocks and mental blocks, personal mental blocks that I might not be able to accommodate. And that is where the requirement of sitting down with other people and understanding what the reservations are, and then coming to a particular consensus and conclusion, and then walking, treading that path together in whatever shape that it looks like. Personally, I would prefer if the entire diaspora came under a particular banner. Everybody takes a certain subject. Everybody has a particular skill set. Allow them to utilize that skill set to the best of their ability. Somebody might be an IT professional. Give them the tasks, everything relating to IT. Somebody might have social media. Somebody might be good at interviews. Somebody might be excellent at policy writing. Everybody takes a particular task. Become the best at it. Form a consensus, form a collective, and then, I know this sounds utopian, but then walk, tread the path together. Because at the end of the day, you're doing this for a particular cause. You're doing this for the people of Kashmir, not for yourselves, not for your parties, not for your ideologies. Because at the end of the day, I may have a particular ideology that differs to those people inside Kashmir. Or maybe I represent the exact aspirations of those in Kashmir. But that doesn't give me the right to shun everybody else. 51% may say one thing, but there's still a 49% that is a large percentage that think something else. You cannot dismiss those people. So therefore, you have to find that common minimum goal, common minimum agenda, and walk that path together so that you can utilize each other's skill sets and experiences to further that cause to the best of your abilities. And when that day comes, the plebiscite comes of deciding of how Kashmir should look like, separate your paths. There's a Quranic ayah, if you allow me, that lakum dinukum waliyadin. You walk your path and I will walk mine. I mean, loosely translated. And the point is, you follow it literally, is you follow your religion and I follow mine. But until we get to the point of deciding what that religion is, let us walk that path together and see where it takes us. Maybe it could do us good. Maybe it won't. We don't know until we try.
I hate drawing upon this connection, but just religion and aspects of religion, militancy. I know obviously both, bringing both together is very problematic in the first place, but it's sort of a jumping point. Militancy in Kashmir has been a huge problem. It's one of the biggest accusations that India sort of claims to have against the Kashmiris in the first place is the fact that there's militancy and that these things are affecting people on the ground as such. It's obviously also, I think there's an overlap between the culture of resistance and sort of, you know, people and trying to take up a sort of a form of maybe, you know, powerlessness and then trying to take power back and trying to fight against it. There's overlaps between these things and people, and you see this in Afghanistan, you see this in Pakistan, you see this in Palestine, you see the frustration building up amongst the youth and not knowing what they want to do. I've seen this question posed a lot, especially throughout the series as well, by people that have been watching, and they're asking, like, you know, to the militancy that is affecting the youth and is, you know, obviously making things worse on the ground. Do you have anything to say about that? Like, any comments on that or a perspective that you might want to relay on that?
My first comment is, I will not take lessons of ethics in resistance or lessons of morality in resistance from the occupier. They have no right to tell me or anybody in Kashmir the pros and cons of armed resistance in Kashmir. They have no right. there is a provision within the United Nations that allows armed resistance against an occupier that is usurping your land, that is hindering your rights, that is committing genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, crimes against humanity, demographic change in your nation. There is a provision. Although I'm telling you that I can never condemn armed resistance in Kashmir, because I don't remember the world condemning armed resistance against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and other. I mean, if we go into history, it's going to become a massive history lesson. So I'm going to avoid that. So any argument that India has goes through this ear and out the other. They have no right to dictate, to give me lessons, to give anybody lessons about armed resistance inside Kashmir. As for the resistance itself, we have no right to condemn it, nor to condone it. We have only the responsibility to understand why it happens in the first place. That is it. And then represent that reason to the best of our abilities without diminishing their contribution and their sacrifice. We cannot dilute Burhan Wani. We cannot dilute Riaz Neku. We cannot dilute other shuhada. I mean, there's a huge list. I can't go into the entire list. It is a disservice to their sacrifice of what they have done for the people of Kashmir. Whether we like it or not, whether we accept it or not, they did it not for themselves. Nobody goes out willingly knowing that the lifespan of an armed resistance fighter is mere months or weeks. Nobody does that. They know that this is a death sentence. So we must understand why. And the best example that I can give, you know, and I'm not going to go 30 years back. I'm just going to go back to Burhan Wani, who was martyred in 2016. I was in Kashmir when this happened. And the reasons of why he took up armed resistance, or Manan Wani, who was a PhD. I mean, the guy was a scholar. He could have been the cream of the crop in Kashmir. He could have given us guidance and wisdom for the next 30, 40 years, but he chose, he had the pen, he used the pen, he realized the power of the pen, and yet he still took up armed resistance. We can never diminish their ideology, nor can we ever diminish their contribution. We must understand their reasons and understand the build-up that happened inside them, the atrocities that they had to see, the abuse that they had to face, the stories of three-year-old Ayad, for example. Ayad was 3 years old. He witnessed his, this is just maybe a few months back, he witnessed his grandfather being shot dead, and then for as a photo opportunity by the armed forces in Kashmir, he was placed on his grandfather's chest, and then they started taking photos of the armed forces picking him up and, you know, consoling him as if they had nothing to do with this. Ayad is going to grow up, 3 years old, Ayad is going to grow up remembering the sight of his grandfather being killed and blood oozing out of him. What would you tell him in 15, 20, 30 years' time if, God forbid, he decides to take drastic actions? I mean, that's his experience. We look at armed resistance fighters and we see them as bearded fellows who are supposed to be intelligent enough not to take weapons. I mean, they faced what Ayad faced. What do you tell families that have enforced disappearances or half widows and their children that don't know where their father is from the last 10, 15, 20 years? Or that young boy? Let me give you another story of from Kunan Pushpura, twin villages inside Kashmir, where the women between the ages of eight years old and 80 years old were gang raped and raped in front of the men in their family. One of those women was 9 months pregnant. She was gang raped, and then she gave birth to a son with a broken arm 3 days later. If he became an armed resistance fighter, could you blame him? Would we take lessons in morality and ethics and resistance from the occupier that performed that atrocious act, that repulsive act on his mother? And these are the stories in droves, in millions from Kashmir. And that is the reason why people pelt stones, why they resist in any shape or form, be it digitally, intellectually, by the pen, by the sword, by the pebbles, in whatever shape or form. we can never diminish their ideologies and their aspirations, because they have sacrificed far too much for people like myself, privileged, to criticize them or to condemn them. We must sit here, know our place, and represent them to the best of our abilities, despite our own leadings. That is the best way that I can explain this.
Yeah, I mean, it's the perspective that is often very, like, you know, it's overlooked in the mainstream by, you know, you never really hear that perspective, because it's always about, oh, that guy picked up a gun and, you know, but that's it. Exactly. Like, he's, you know, the automatically he's shown exactly. as the person that's the bad guy. Violence, yes. And yeah, it's a narrative that's very difficult to argue against, I think, especially when the sort of quote-unquote liberal democratic Western ideals with this universality
post 9/11,
and, you know, whatever
yes.
we're trying to exactly that we're trying to project. And it, I mean, I think this is an issue throughout most of the Muslim majority world because of post 9/11 and the armed resistance has come about within, you know, and the helplessness, the frustration, the daily, you know, things that people on the ground get to have to see, and the frustration that's building up, and the powerlessness, and how that must, you know, plague the youth, and the effect that it has on people, or not even just the youth, but everybody that's there on the ground. It's very difficult to understand and make that connection. But then it's constantly overlooked. I don't hear this perspective anywhere, to be
I'll
honest.
Give you one small example of a young boy in 2016 when the pellets started being used indiscriminately in Kashmir. And I spent a lot of time in the hospitals just trying to do what I can. And I met some young kids as well. And one of them told me, when I said to him, you know, how did this happen? He said that we were pelting stones because, again, somebody had been killed. And therefore, I mean, the narrative always from India is that these people are intrinsically violent. They are born violent. And therefore, they are violent towards us. But it's a cause and effect that many people don't realize. So anyway, this young boy was resisting, as others were doing. And he had pellets in his eye. And the doctor said he's probably going to be permanently blinded. And I said to him, you know, with respect, I said, do you have any regret? And he said to me, I think he may have been quoting a film dialogue, but he said to me, God gave me another eye. I'm okay. And I said to him, in what context do you say? I said, so are you going to, like, use your internet or use your words instead? He said, no. He said, God gave me another eye to focus on the oppressor and pelt more stones at him. So, I mean, this is just one simple story. There are so many different stories from Kashmir that aren't given the time of day because, number one, we need to protect their identity. But also, number two, it tarnishes the image of the occupier and the oppressor. It tarnishes the image of India. If you look at Indian media and the Indian liberals and those that support Kashmir, they do it within a particular framework in a particular box, that they will support you to the hilt. But the moment you talk about Azadi and the right to self-determination, they will disown you. Like anything. And that's the problem, that if you're going to support us unconditionally. If you're going to help us on our terms, not on yours. And so when we represent the people of Kashmir, we must represent them truly. We must represent them efficiently, and we must represent them with honesty. And that is something that we need to get better at, all of us. Even the media, even be it the Western media, the liberal media, the diaspora, the supporters, whoever it may be, we must represent the people justly. Because they will hold us accountable. They will hold us one day accountable. And that is what I'm afraid of.
I think that's what we all should be afraid of, is the accountability that comes afterwards. Those have been very interesting remarks. I mean, our time is technically coming to an end, but are there any other closing remarks that you would like to add on the issue, or to do with like your own identity as such and like the Kashmir matter and stuff?
You know, your entire theme, the identity, it's been very good because even it gave me the opportunity to actually think, how did I get to where I am today? I mean, there must have been a cause and effect correlation. And so for me, I will emphasize again that it was the experience. I mean, my existence is linked to my family, of course, and it is what my family went through, particularly my father. And that is, my identity is linked to him. And through him, it is linked to Kashmir and the cause of Kashmir. And that's the conclusion that I have come to when you asked me to come on this platform. That question was posed of, this is what we're going to talk about. And ultimately, in the month or so long percolation that happened in my brain of what this actually means, and it really did, I really did want to say something purely academic or something purely poetic. And I thought, to do justice to myself, that this is actually where it stemmed from. That before I saw Kashmir, I saw my father, and I saw what he went through, and I heard his stories, and I saw what he was speaking about. And that motivated me to learn more. And then upon his passing, I learned more, and I wanted to fulfill his goal, his aspirations, his dream, Sadaqa Jariya as well. So that was what identity meant to me. So Kashmir is very, very personal for me. It isn't just about nationalism or identity or culture or food or clothes. It's a legacy. And in terms of conclusion, if there's any final remarks, I would say that when you support other causes around the world and you find them just, there is no reason not to support the cause of Kashmir. And when you support the cause of Kashmir, you support those people that are on the front line. You represent them to the best of your ability. You give them the respect and the adulations that they deserve. The sacrifices that they have given should never go unnoticed. And those that are advocating in the diaspora, support them, endorse them, encourage them. Creating new entities in relation to Kashmir is diluting the language, the narrative, and the work that already has been going on. And again, not to sound too utopian and a hippie, but working in coordination and correlation and working as one on a particular platform with a particular agenda is not going to hurt you. It is going to hurt the oppressor. That is what they don't want to see. They do not want to see unity. They do not want to see people working together. They want to sow seeds of discord. And we should never fall into that trap. And the same goes with the supporters, the non-Kashmiri supporters, or even those that are that support Kashmir as Kashmiris, that we need to stop cutting each other off. We need to stop criminalizing or delegitimizing one another because of our ideologies or our aspirations. And we need to find the common goal. We need to find the common agendas. We need to find the commonality between us and other causes. When we see the Palestinians and we empathize with them, we see the people of Myanmar, the Rohingya, and we empathize with them. We see those Uyghurs and what they go through as well. And we empathize and sympathize with them. And therefore, when we lend our support to them, we should also ask for their support in return. But again, understand what our commonalities are. Separate the differences. And inshallah, we should be able to at least dent the occupiers' plans. And you have to remember, we know what their agenda is. It's not like they've kept it hidden, particularly this BJP backed by the RSS government. We know what their agenda is. We know the expansionist program that they have, the Hindutva agenda that they have, a pan-Hindu nation, to the extent that, I mean, people need to understand that we didn't make this, Kashmiris didn't make this a religious problem. We didn't start the armed violence. India did. They were in guns and tanks. They were the ones that committed atrocities inside Kashmir. They are the ones that made this into a communal issue, into a Hindu-Muslim issue. And they continue to do so. And they are banking on it. The reason why the BJP wins in India is because they bank on the anti-Muslim, anti-Pakistan and anti-Kashmir sentiment. We didn't make this a Hindu-Muslim issue. They did. So therefore, we should stop being on the defensive. And I know that post 9/11, Muslims have had a bit of an issue that we've and Islamophobia is a real thing. But let me also tell you that Hindus are starting to coin their own terminology of Hindu-phobia, if you can believe that. So we need to understand not just the context of Kashmir and what the advocacy requires and what the people are saying. We must understand our enemy. We must give them, even them, the respect that they deserve. Respect not by saluting them saying, being polite to them, but respect in the sense that know your enemy well enough to respect the strategy that they have and not dismiss it as some kind of fringe philosophy. These are not fringe philosophies and fringe ideologies. These are mainstream in India. So we must recognize it and then change our strategies to make sure that we are able to counter that as well as the liberation of Kashmir. And we've also seen the minorities inside India. So we need to also work with them as well. But ultimately, the bottom line is, as Kashmiri diaspora, people from the valley, we know what happens in Kashmir. Somebody that I know very well usually says, the owner of the shoe knows where it pinches or something like that. So we know what the crisis in Kashmir is. Mm. We know what the problems are. So when representation is required in the British Parliament, in the American Senate or the Congress, or in the European Parliament, or in the Turkish Parliament, or in the OIC or the United Nations, it should be indigenous people that represent their cause, because they can do it the best. If you know Ahad Tamimi, if you know this name, she was a blonde, curly-haired Palestinian girl. Yeah. She became a figurehead of the Palestinian movement recently. Why? Because she was Palestinian. If you remember that North Korean girl that testified in the United Nations several years ago, she became a figurehead for the North Korean resistance because she was North Korean. Let us look at the Palestinian. You need to have indigenous representation because they can truly represent, and they truly know what happens to their families on the ground and to other families on the ground. So I hope that this message is to those people that are watching this, to support those people that represent Kashmir inside Kashmir and outside Kashmir. Give them the tools and the resources and the manpower that they require. Give them the support that they crave, and be part of the team that inshallah liberates Kashmir from the occupier and the subjugator.
Inshallah. And what an inspirational note to end on. That was very insightful. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you to our audience for watching. Our final episode will be on next Saturday, not this Thursday, but it will be at the same time, and we'll be in conversation with founder of Made in Kashmir, Muhammad Faisal. And I would like to thank everybody again. Yes, so we've been told. Thank you again on behalf of our Identity International, and we shall see you soon.